Perhaps they are no more than obstacles to be negotiated in the ultimate sightlessness of the world. In the morning, when he walked out to saddle his horse, the woman was scattering grain from a bota to the birds in the yard. Wild blackbirds flew down from the trees and stalked and fed among the poultry, but she fed all without discrimination. The boy watched her. He thought she was very beautiful. He saddled the horse and left it standing and said his goodbyes and then mounted up and rode out. When he looked back, she raised her hand. The birds were all about her. "Vaya con Dios," she called. He turned the horse into the road. He'd not gone far when the dog came out of the chaparral and fell in beside the horse. He had been in a fight, and he was cut and bloody and held one paw to his chest. Billy halted the horse and looked down at him. The dog limped forward a few steps and stood. "Where's Boyd?" Billy said. The dog pricked its ears and looked about. "You dumbass." The dog looked toward the house. "He was in the truck. He ain't here." He put the horse forward and the dog fell in behind and they set out north along the road. Before noon, they struck the main road north to Casas Grandes, and he sat in that empty desert crossroads and looked off up country and back to the south, but there was nothing to be seen save sky and road and desert. The sun stood almost overhead. He slid the shotgun out of the dusty leather scabbard and unbreached it and took out the shell and looked at the wad end to see what size shot it held. It was number 5, and he thought about putting in the buckshot load, but in the end he put the number 5 shell back in the chamber and breached the gun shut and put it back in the scabbard and set out north along the road to San Diego, the dog limping at the horse's heels. "Where's Boyd?" he said. "Where's Boyd?" That night he slept in a field wrapped in the blanket the woman had given him. The breaks of a river lay across the plain, perhaps a mile distant, and that was the way the horse would have gone. He lay on the cooling earth and watched the stars, the dark shape of the horse off to his left where he'd staked it, the horse raising its head above the skyline to listen among the constellations, and then bending to graze again. He studied those worlds sprawled in their pale ignitions upon the nameless night, and he tried to speak to God about his brother, and after a while he slept. He slept and woke from a troubling dream and could not sleep again. He trudged in his dream through a deep snow along a ridge toward a darkened house, and the wolves had followed him as far as the fence. They ran their lean mouths against each other's flanks, and they flowed about his knees and furrowed the snow with their noses and tossed their heads, and in the cold their pooled breath made a cauldron about him, and the snow lay so blue in the moonlight, and those eyes were pale as topaz where they crouched and whined and tucked their tails. And they fawned and shuddered as they drew close to the house, and their teeth shone that were so white, and their red tongues lolled. At the gate they would go no further. They looked back toward the dark shapes of the mountains. He knelt in the snow and reached out his arms to them, and they touched his face with their wild muzzles and drew away again, and their breath was warm, and it smelled of the earth and the heart of the earth. When the last of them had come forward, they stood in a crescent before him, and their eyes were like footlights to the ordinate world, and then they turned and wheeled away and loped off through the snow and vanished smoking into the winter night. In the house his parents slept, and when he crawled into his bed, Boyd turned to him and whispered that he'd had a dream, and in the dream Billy had run away from home, and when he woke from the dream and seen his empty bed, he'd thought that it was true. "Go to sleep," Billy said. "You won't run off and leave me, will you, Billy?" "No." "You promise?" "Yes, I promise." "No matter what?" "Yes, no matter what." "Billy?" "Go to sleep." "Billy?" "Hush, you'll wake them." But in the dream, Boyd only said softly that they would not wake. The dawn was long in coming. He rose and walked out on the desert prairie and scanned the east for light. In the gray beginnings of the day, the calls of doves from the acacias, a wind coming down from the north. He rolled the blanket and ate the last of the tortillas and the boiled eggs she'd given him, and he saddled the horse and rode out as the sun came up out of the ground to the east. Within the hour, it was raining. He untied the blanket from behind him and pulled it over his shoulders. He could see the rain coming across the country in a grey wall, and soon it was pounding the flat grey clay of the Bahada through which he rode. The horse plodded on. The dog walked beside. They looked like what they were, outcasts in an alien land. Homeless, hunted, weary. He rode all day the broad Barial between the breaks of the river and the long straight bight of the roadway to the west. The rain slacked, but it did not stop. It rained all day. Twice he saw riders ahead on the plain, and he halted the horse, but the riders rode on. In the evening he crossed the railroad tracks and entered the pueblo of Mata Ortiz. He halted before the door of a small blue tienda, and got down and half-hitched the reins to a post, and entered and stood in the partial darkness. A woman's voice spoke to him. He asked her if there was a doctor in this place. "Medico?" she said. "Medico?" She was sitting in a chair at the end of the counter with what looked like a fly whisk cradled in her arms. "En este pueblo," he said. She studied him, as if trying to ascertain the nature of his illness or his wounds. She said that there was no doctor nearer than Casas Grandes. Then she half rose out of the chair and began to hiss and to make shooing gestures at him with the whisk. "Ma'am?" he said. She fell back laughing. She shook her head and put her hand to her mouth. "No," she said, "no. El perro, dispénsame." He turned and saw the dog standing in the doorway behind him. The woman rose heavily, still laughing, and came forward, tugging at a pair of old wire-rimmed spectacles. She set them on the bridge of her nose and took him by the arm and turned him to the light. "Güero," she said, "busca el herido, no?" "Es mi hermano." They stood in silence. She had not turned loose of his arm. He tried to see into her eyes, but the light played off the glass of her spectacles, and one of the panes was half opaque with dirt, as if perhaps she had no vision in that eye and saw no need to clean it. "El vivía?" he said. She said that he was living when he passed by her door, and that people had followed the truck to the end of the town, and that he was alive to the limits of Mata Ortiz, and beyond that, who could say? He thanked her and turned to go. "Es su perro?" she said. He said that it was his brother's dog. She said that she'd guessed as much, for the dog wore a worried look. She looked out into the street where the horse stood. "Es su caballo?" she said. "Sí." She nodded. "Bueno," she said. "Monte caballero. Monte y vaya con Dios." He thanked her and walked out to the horse and untied it and mounted up. He turned and touched the brim of his hat to the old woman where she stood in the door. "Momento," she called. He waited. In a moment a young girl came out and eased past the woman and came to the stirrup of his horse and looked up at him. She was very pretty and very shy. She held up one hand, her fist closed. "¿Qué tiene?" he said.
"Tómelo."
He held out his hand, and she dropped into it a small silver heart. He turned it to the light and looked at it. He asked her what it was.
"Un milagro," she said.
"Milagro?"
"Sí, para el güero herido."
He turned the heart in his hand and looked down at her. "No hará herido en el corazón," he said. But she only looked away and did not answer, and he thanked her and dropped the heart into his shirt pocket. "Gracias," he said. "Muchas gracias." She stepped back from the horse.
"Qué joven tan valiente," she said,
and he agreed that indeed his brother was brave, and he touched his hat again and raised his hand to the old woman where she stood in the doorway, still clutching the whisk, and he put the horse forward down the single mud street of Mata Ortiz, north toward San Diego. It was dark and starless from the overcast of rain when he crossed the bridge and rode up the hill toward the domicilios. The same dogs sallied forth howling and circled the horse, and he rode past the dimly lighted doorways and past the remains of the evening fires where the haze of wood smoke hung over the compound in the damp air. He saw no one run to carry news of his arrival, yet when he arrived at the door of the Munoz house, the woman was standing there waiting for him. People were coming out of the houses. He sat the horse and looked down at her.
"¿El está?"
he said.
"Sí, el está."
"El vive?"
"El vive." He dismounted and handed the reins to the boy standing nearest in the company gathered about him, and took off his hat and entered the low doorway. The woman followed him. Boyd lay on a pallet at the far side of the room. The dog was already curled on the pallet with him. About him on the floor stood gifts of food and gifts of flowers and holy images of wood or clay or cloth, and little handmade wooden boxes that held milagros and ollas and baskets and glass bottles and figurines. In the wall niche above him, a candle in the glass burned at the feet of the poor wooden Madonna, but there was no light other.
"Regalos de los obreros," the woman whispered.
"Del ejido?" She said that some of the gifts were from the ejido, but that mostly they were from the workers who had carried him here. She said the truck had returned and the men had filed in holding their hats and placed these gifts before him. Billy squatted and looked down at Boyd. He pulled back the blanket and pushed up the shirt he wore. Boyd was wrapped in muslin windings like someone dressed for death, and he'd bled through the cloth and the blood was dry and black. He put his hand on his brother's forehead, and Boyd opened his eyes.
"How you doing, partner?" he said.
"I thought they got you," Boyd whispered. "I thought you was dead."
"I'm right here."
"That good Nino horse."
"Yeah, that good Nino horse."
"He was pale and hot. You know what I am today?" he said.
"No, what are you?"
15, if I don't make it another day."
"Don't you worry about that."
He turned to the woman.
"¿Qué dice el médico?"
The woman shook her head. There was no doctor. They'd sent for an old woman no more than a bruja, and she had bound his wounds with a poultice of herbs and given him a tea to drink.
"¿Y qué dice la bruja? ¿Es grave?"
The woman turned away. In the light from the niche, she could see the tears on her dark face. She bit her lower lip. She did not answer.
"Damn you," he whispered.
It was 3 o'clock in the morning when he rode into Casas Grandes. He crossed the high embankment of the railroad track and rode up Alameda Street until he saw a light in a cantina. He dismounted and went in. At a table near the bar, a man lay asleep in his crossed arms, and otherwise the room was empty. "Hombre," Billy said. The man jerked upright. The boy before him had every air of those bearing grave news. He sat warily with his hands on the table at either side.
"El médico," Billy said. "Donde vive el médico?"
The doctor's mozo unlocked and unlatched the door cut into the wooden gate and stood there just inside the darkened saguan. He did not speak, but only waited to hear the supplicant's tale. When Billy was done, he nodded.
"Bueno," he said. "Pásale."
He stepped aside and Billy entered, and the mozo resecured the door.
"Espere aquí," he said.
Then he went padding away over the cobbles and disappeared in the dark. He waited a long time. From the rear of the saguan came the smell of green plants and earth and humus, a rustle of wind, of things disturbed that had been sleeping. Outside the gate, Nino whinnied softly. Finally, a light came on in the patio and the mozo reappeared. Behind him, the doctor. He was not dressed, but came forward in his robe, one hand in his robe pocket. A small and unkempt man.
"¿Dónde está su hermano?" he said.
"En el ejido de San Diego."
"¿Y cuándo ocurrió ese accidente?"
"Hace 2 días."
The doctor studied the boy's face in the pale and yellow light.
"He is very hot?"
"I don't know. Yes, some."
The doctor nodded.
"Bueno," he said.
He told the mozo to start the car and then turned back to Billy.
"I will need some minutes," he said. 5 minutes.
He held up one hand and spread his fingers.
"Yes, sir."
"You have nothing to pay, of course."
"I got a good horse outside. I'll give you the horse."
"I don't want your horse."
"I got papers on him. Tengo los papeles."
The doctor had already turned to go.
"Bring in the horse," he said. "You can put your horse here."
"Have you got room to where we can take the saddle with us?"
"The saddle?"
"I'd like to keep the saddle. My daddy gave it to me. I got no way to carry it back."
"You can carry it back on the horse."
You won't take the horse?
No, it is all right.
He stood outside in the street holding Nino while the mozo slid back the bars and opened the tall wooden gates. He started through leading the horse, but the mozo cautioned him back and told him to wait, and then turned and disappeared. After a while, he heard the car start up, and the mozo came driving up through the saguan in an old Dodge Opera coupe. He drove out into the street and got out and left the motor running and took the bridle reins and led the horse in through the gates and on toward the rear. In a few minutes, the doctor appeared. He was dressed in a dark suit, and the mozo followed behind, carrying his medical bag.
Listo? The doctor said.
Listo. The doctor walked around the car and climbed in. The mozo handed in the bag and shut the door. Billy climbed in the other side, and the doctor turned on the lights, and the motor died. He sat waiting. The mozo opened the door and reached under the seat and got the crank and walked around in front of the car, and the doctor turned the lights off. The mozo bent and fitted the crank into the slot and raised up and gave it a turn, and the motor started again. The doctor ran the engine up loudly and turned the lights back on and rolled down the window and took the crank from the mozo. Then he pulled the shift lever in the floor down into first, and they pulled away. The street was narrow and ill-lit, and the yellow beams of the headlamps ran out to a wall at the end of it. A family of people were just entering the street, the man walking ahead, behind him a woman and two half-grown girls carrying baskets and shabbily tied bundles. They froze in the headlights like deer, and their postures mimicked the shadows volunteered outsized upon the wall behind them, the man standing upright and erect and the woman and the older girl throwing up one arm as if to protect themselves. The doctor levered the big wooden steering wheel to the left, and the headlights swung away, and the figures vanished once more into the indeterminate dark of the Mexican night.
"Tell me of this accident," the doctor said.
"My brother got shot in the chest with a rifle."
"And when did this happen?"
2 days ago."
"Does he speak?"
"Sir?"
"Does he speak? Is he awake?"
"Yes, sir, he's awake. He never did talk much."
"Yes," said the doctor, "of course."
He lit a cigarette and smoked quietly on the road south. He said that the car had a radio and that Billy could play it if he wished, but Billy thought that the doctor would play it himself if he wanted to hear it. After a while, the doctor did so. They listened to American hillbilly music coming out of Acuna on the Texas border, and the doctor drove and smoked in silence, and the hot eyes of cattle feeding in the bar ditches at the side of the road floated up in the car lights, and everywhere the desert stretched away in the dark beyond. They turned up the Ejido Road through the river loam and the pale shapes of the cottonwood trunks passing in the lights, and lumbered over the wooden bridge and up the hill and into the compound. The Ejido dogs crossed back and forth in the lights, howling. Billy pointed their way, and they drove up past the darkened doors of the sleeping communals, and halted before the dim yellow light where his brother lay within among his offerings like some feast day icon. The doctor shut off the engine and the lights and reached for the bag, but Billy had already taken it to carry. He nodded and stepped out of the car and adjusted his hat and entered the house with Billy behind him. The Munoz woman had already come from the other room, and she stood in the frail light of the votive candle in the only dress Billy had ever seen her in, and wished the doctor a good evening. The doctor handed her his hat and then unbuttoned his coat and slipped it from his shoulders and held it up and turned it and reached his glasses in their case from the inside pocket. Then he handed the coat to the woman and removed his cufflinks left and right and put them in his trouser pocket and turned up his starched white shirt sleeves 2 turns each and sat on the low pallet and took the glasses from their case and put them on and looked at Boyd. He placed one hand on Boyd's forehead.
¿Cómo estás? He said. ¿Cómo te sientes?
Nunca mejor, wheezed Boyd. The doctor smiled. He turned to the woman.
Llévame algo de agua, he said.
Then he took from his pocket a small nickel-plated flashlight and leaned over Boyd. Boyd closed his eyes, but the doctor pulled down the lower lid of each eye in turn and examined them. He waved the light slowly back and forth across the pupils and looked in. Boyd tried to turn his head away, but the doctor had placed his hand alongside his cheek.
Véame, he said.
He pulled back the blanket. Something small scurried away over the muslin. Boyd was wearing one of the white cotton jumpers the workers in the field wore, and it had neither collar nor buttons. The doctor pushed it up and pulled Boyd's right elbow down from the sleeve and pulled it over his head, and then very carefully pulled the garment down off of Boyd's left arm and handed it to Billy without even looking at him. Boyd lay wrapped in cotton sheeting, and his wound had bled through the winding, and the blood had dried and blackened. The doctor slid the flat of his hand up under the wrappings and placed his hand on Boyd's chest. "Respire," he said. "Respire profundo." Boyd breathed, but his breathing was shallow and labored. The doctor slid his hand to the left side of his chest, near to the dark stains in the sheeting, and told him to breathe again. He bent and unsnapped the clasps on his bag and took out his stethoscope and hung it around his neck, and he took out a pair of spade-ended scissors and cut through the filthy windings and lifted back the severed ends all stiff with blood. He placed his fingers on Boyd's naked chest and tapped his left middle finger with his right and listened. He moved his hand and thumped again. He moved his hand down to Boyd's caved and sallow abdomen and probed gently with his fingers. He watched the boy's face. "Tienes muchos amigos," he said, "no?"
"Cómo?" wheezed Boyd.
"Tantos regalos." He lifted the earpieces of the stethoscope into place and put the cone on Boyd's chest and listened. He moved it from the right to the left. "Respire profundo," he said. "Por la boca. Otra vez. Bueno." He placed the cone over Boyd's heart and listened. He listened with his eyes closed.
"Billy,"
Boyd wheezed.
"Shh,"
said the doctor. He put his fingers to his lips.
"No habla."
He dropped the earpieces of the stethoscope down about his neck, and he lifted by its chain a gold case watch from his waistcoat pocket and snapped it open with his thumb. He sat with two fingers pressed to the side of Boyd's neck beneath his jaw, and he tilted the white porcelain face of the watch toward the votive lamp and sat watching quietly while the needle-thin sweep-second hand sectored the dial with its small black Roman numbers.
"¿Cuándo puedo yo hablar?" Boyd whispered.
The doctor smiled. "Ahora si quieres," he said.
"Billy?"
"Yeah?"
"You don't have to stay."
"I'm all right."
"You don't have to stay if you don't want. It's all right."
"I ain't going nowheres." The doctor slid the watch back into his waistcoat. "Saca la lengua," he said. He examined Boyd's tongue, and he put his finger inside Boyd's mouth and felt the inner face of his cheek. Then he bent and picked up the bag and set it on the pallet beside him and opened the bag and tilted it slightly toward the light. The bag was of heavy pebbled leather dyed black, and it was scuffed and worn at the corners, and the leather there and along the edges had gone brown again. The brass catches were worn from 80 years of use, for his father had carried it before him. He took out a blood pressure cuff and wrapped it around Boyd's thin upper arm and pumped the contrivance with the bulb. He placed the cone of the stethoscope in the crook of Boyd's arm and listened. He watched the needle drop and watched it bounce. In the panes of his antique eyeglasses, the thin and upright flame of the votive lamp stood centered, very small, very steadfast, like the light of holy inquiry burning in his aging eyes. He unwound the cloth and turned to Billy.
"Hay una mesa chica en la casa? ¿O una silla?"
"Hay una silla."
"Bueno, traígala. Y traígame un contenedor de agua, una bota o cualquier cosa que tenga."
"Sí, señor."
"Y traiga un vaso de agua potable."
"Yes, sir."
"El debe tomar agua. ¿Me entiendes?"
"Yes, sir."
"Y deja abierta la puerta. Necesitamos aire."
"Yes, sir, I will." He came back carrying the chair upside down over his arm by the rung, and he had a clay olla of water in one hand and a cup of well water in the other. The doctor had risen, and he had donned a white apron, and he was holding a towel and a bar of dark-looking soap.
"Bueno,"
he said. He folded the soap in the towel and stuck it beneath his arm, and took the chair from Billy carefully, and righted it and set it on the floor and turned it slightly in the place he wished for it to go. He took the olla from Billy and set it on the chair, and he bent and sorted through his bag, and came up with a bent glass straw, and stood it in the cup Billy was holding. He said for him to give his brother the water to drink. He said for him to see that he drank slowly.
"Yes, sir," Billy said.
"Bueno," said the doctor. He took the towel from under his arm and rolled his sleeves up each another turn. He looked down at Billy.
"No te preocupes," he said.
"Yes, sir," said Billy. "I'll try." The doctor nodded and turned and left to go wash his hands. Billy sat on the pallet and leaned forward and held the cup and the straw for Boyd to drink.
"I can pull these covers up," he said. "Are you cold? You ain't cold, are you?"
"I ain't cold."
"Here you go."
Boyd drank.
"Don't drink too fast," Billy said.
He tilted the cup.
"You look like one of these dirt farmers in that rig."
Boyd drank deeply through the straw and then turned away coughing.
"Don't drink so fast."
He lay getting his breath. He drank again. Billy took the cup away and waited and then offered it again. The glass pipe rattled and sucked. He tilted the cup. When Boyd had drunk all the water, he lay getting his breath and he looked up at Billy.
"There's worse things to look like," he said.
Billy set the cup on the chair.
"I didn't take much care of you, did I?" he said.
Boyd didn't answer.
"The doctor says you're going to be all right."
Boyd lay breathing shallowly, his head back. He stared at the dark vigas of the ceiling overhead.
"He says you're going to be good as new."
"I didn't hear him say it," Boyd said.
When the doctor came back, Billy picked up the cup and rose and stood holding it. The doctor was drying his hands.
"Tenía sed, verdad?"
"Yes, sir," Billy said. The woman came through the door carrying a pail of steaming water. Billy went to her and took the bucket by the bail, and the doctor gestured for him to place it on the hearth. He folded the towel and laid it by his bag and laid the soap on top of it and sat.
"Bueno," he said, "bueno."
He turned to Billy.
"Ayúdame," he said.
Together, they turned Boyd on his side. Boyd gasped and clutched about in the air with one hand. He seized Billy's shoulder.
"Easy, partner," Billy said. "I know it hurts."
"No, you don't," wheezed Boyd.
"Está bien," said the doctor.
"Está bien así."
He gently pulled away the stained and blackened sheeting from Boyd's chest and lifted it free and handed it up to the woman. He left the black and weedy poultices in place, the one on his chest and the larger one behind his shoulder. He leaned over the boy and pressed the poultices gently each in turn to see if anything should run from beneath them, and he tested the air tentatively with his nose for any hint of rot.
"Bueno," he said, "bueno."
He touched gently the area under Boyd's arm between the poultices where the skin was blue and swollen-looking.
"La entrada es en el pecho, ¿no?"
"Sí," said Billy.
He nodded and took up the towel and soap and dipped the towel in the olla of water and soaped it and set about cleaning Boyd's back and chest, washing carefully around the poultices and under his arm. He rinsed the towel in the olla and squeezed it out and bent and wiped away the soap. The towel where he turned it was dark with grime.
"¿No estás demasiado frío?" he said. "¿Estás cómodo?"
"Bueno, bueno."
When he was done, he laid the towel by and set the olla in the floor and leaned and took from his bag a folded towel which he laid on the chair and opened carefully with just his fingertips. Inside was a second towel, cured in the autoclave and done up in a bundle fastened with tape. He gently pried loose and lifted away the tape, and holding the edges delicately between thumb and finger, he spread the towel open upon the chair seat. Inside were gauze squares and squares of muslin and cotton balls, small folded towels, rolls of cloth bandage. He lifted his hands away without touching anything, and he took two small enameled pans nested together from his bag, and one he laid near the bag and the other he leaned and dipped partly full of hot water from the bucket, and then conveyed it carefully in both hands to the chair and set it at the edge of the chair away from the bandages. He selected from their fitted compartments in his case his tools of nickel steel, sharp-nosed scissors and forceps and hemostats, some dozen in number. Boyd watched. Billy watched. He dropped the instruments into the pan, and he took from the bag a small red bulb syringe and placed that in the pan, and he took out a small tin of bismuth, and he took out two small sticks of silver nitrate and unwrapped them from out of their foil coverings and laid them on the towel beside the pan. Then he took out a bottle of iodine and loosed the cap and passed the bottle up to the woman, and he held his hands over the pan and instructed her to pour the iodine over his hands. She stepped forward and took the cap from the bottle.
"Andale," he said.
She poured. Más, he said. Un poquito más. Because the outer door was open, the flame in the glass fluttered and twisted, and the little light that it afforded waxed and waned and threatened to expire entirely. The three of them bent over the poor pallet where the boy lay looked like ritual assassins.
Bastante, said the doctor.
Bueno. He held up his dripping hands. They were dyed a rusty brown. The iodine moved in the pan like marbling blood. He nodded to the woman.
Ponga el resto en el agua, he said.
She poured the remainder of the iodine into the pan, and the doctor tested the water with one finger, and then quickly fished a hemostat from the pan, and with the hemostat he took up a packet of the muslin squares and dipped them and held them up to drain. He turned to the woman again.
Bueno, he said. Quita la cataplasma.
She put one hand to her mouth. She looked at Boyd, and she looked at the doctor.
Ándale, pues, he said. Está bien.
She blessed herself and bent and reached and took hold of the rag that bound the poultice and lifted it and slid her thumb beneath the poultice and pulled it away. It was of matted weeds and dark with blood, and it came away unwillingly, like something that had been feeding there. She stepped back and folded it from sight in the dirty sheeting. Boyd lay in the flickering light of the votive candle with a small round hole a few inches above and to the left of his left nipple. The wound was dry and crusted and pale-looking. The doctor bent and swabbed it carefully with the cotton. The iodine stained Boyd's skin. Blood welled slowly in the hole, and a thin line of it ran across Boyd's chest. The doctor laid a clean gauze square over the wound. They watched it slowly darken with blood. The doctor looked up at the woman.
La otra, she said.
Sí, por favor. She leaned and freed the poultice from Boyd's back with her thumb and lifted it away. Larger, blacker, uglier. Beneath it was a ragged hole that yawned redly. About it the flesh was crusted with scale and blackened blood. The doctor placed a sheaf of the gauze squares over the wound and placed a square of muslin over them and pressed upon it with the tips of his fingers and held it there. Slowly the cloth darkened. The doctor placed more patches. A thin trickle of blood ran down Boyd's back. The doctor swabbed it up and pressed again with the tips of his fingers against the wound. When the bleeding had stopped, he took a cloth and dipped it in the iodine solution in the pan, and while he held the packing against the wound in the boy's back, he set to cleaning closely about both wounds. He dropped the soiled swabs in the dry tray beside him, and when he was done, he pushed his glasses up on the bridge of his nose with the back of his wrist and looked at Billy.
Take his hand, he said.
Mande?
Take his hand.
No sé si me va permitir.
Él te permite.
He sat on the edge of the pallet and took hold of Boyd's hand, and Boyd clasped it in his grip.
Do your damnedest, Boyd whispered.
¿Qué dice?
Nada, said Billy. Ándale.
The doctor took a sterile cloth and wrapped it around the little flashlight and turned the flashlight on and picked it up and put it in his mouth. Then he dropped the cloth into the pan with the swabs and leaned and took a hemostat from the pan and bent over Boyd and gently lifted away the pads from the exit wound and trained his light upon it. The blood was already beginning to well anew, and he placed the hemostat in the wound and snapped it shut. Boyd bowed and threw his head back, but he did not cry out. The doctor took another hemostat from the pan, and he dabbed up the blood with a cloth patch and studied the wound with the light, and then clamped again. The tendons in Boyd's neck shone taut in the lamplight. The doctor gripped the flashlight in his teeth.
Unos pocos minutos más, he said. Unos pocos minutos.
He placed two more hemostats, and then he took the red bulb syringe from the pan and filled it with the solution, and he instructed the woman to take the towel and hold it against the boy's back. Then he slowly flooded the wound. He cleaned the wound with a swab and flooded it again, washing out clots of blood and bits of matter. He reached into the pan with his hand and brought up a hemostat and clamped it in place.
Pobrecito, said the woman.
Unos pocos minutos más, said the doctor.
He flooded the wound out once again with the syringe, and he took up one of the sticks of silver nitrate, and with a muslin swab held in a hemostat in one hand, he cleaned away clots and debris, while with the other he cauterized with the silver nitrate. The silver nitrate left pale gray tracks in the tissue. He clamped one more hemostat and again flooded the wound. The woman doubled the towel against Boyd's back and held it. With the forceps, the doctor picked out something small from the wound and held it to the light. It was about the size of a grain of wheat, and he held it and turned it in the small cone of light.
¿Qué es eso? Billy said.
The doctor leaned with the flashlight in his teeth so that the boy could see better.
Plomo, he said.
But it was a small chip flaked off from Boyd's sixth rib, and he was referring to the faint metal coloring along the conchoidal edge of the bone. He laid it on the towel, together with the forceps, and with his forefinger he felt along Boyd's ribs from front to back. He watched Boyd's face while he did so.
¿Te duele? He said. ¿Alá? ¿Alá?
Boyd lay with his face turned away. He sounded as if he could hardly breathe. The doctor took a pair of small, sharp-nosed scissors from the pan and glanced at Billy, and then began to snip away the dead tissue along the edges of the wound. Billy reached and took Boyd's hand in both of his.
¿Le interesa el perro? The doctor said.
Billy looked toward the door. The dog sat watching them.
Git, he said. Está bien, the doctor said. No lo molesta. ¿Este su hermano, no?
Sí. The doctor nodded. When he was done, he instructed the woman to hold the towel beneath the wound in the boy's chest, and then he flooded and cleaned it also. He flooded it again, and he probed it with a swab. Finally, he sat back and took the flashlight from his mouth and laid it on the towel and looked at Billy.
Es un muchacho muy valiente, he said.
Es grave, said Billy.
Es grave, the doctor said. Pero no es muy grave.
¿Qué sería muy grave? The doctor adjusted his spectacles, pushing them back again with his wrist. It had grown cold in the room. You could see very faintly the doctor's breath plume and lapse in the lapsing light. A light bead of sweat lay across his forehead. He made the sign of the cross in the air before him.
Eso, he said. Eso es muy grave.
He reached and took up the flashlight again, holding it in one of the muslin squares. He put it in his teeth and took up the bulb and refilled it and laid it by, and then slowly unclamped the first of the hemostats that lay in a circle of hardware about the wound in Boyd's back. He drew it away very slowly. Then he unclamped the next. He took up the bulb and gently washed the wound and swabbed it and took up the silver nitrate stick and gently touched it in the wound. He worked from the top of the wound downward. When he had removed the last hemostat and dropped it into the pan, he sat for a moment with both hands over Boyd's back as if exhorting him to heal. Then he took up the tin of bismuth and unscrewed the lid and held it over the wounds and shook the white powder over them. He laid gauze squares on the wounds, and over the wound in the boy's back he placed a small clean towel from among his sterile dressings, and he taped them down, and then he and Billy eased Boyd up, and the doctor quickly wrapped him about with a roll of cloth bandaging, passing the roll under his arms until he reached the end of it. He fastened the end with two small steel clamps, and they pulled Boyd's jumper back over him and eased him down again. His head lolled, and he sucked a long, rasping breath.
Fue muy afortunado, the doctor said.
¿Cómo?
Que no se le han punzado los pulmones. Que no se le ha quebrado la gran arteria, cual era muy cerca de la dirección de la bala. Pero sobre todo, que no hay ni gran infección. Muy afortunado.
He wrapped his instruments in the towel and placed them in his bag, and he emptied the basins into the bucket and swabbed them out and put them away and closed the bag. He rinsed and dried his hands, and stood and took his cufflinks from his pocket and rolled down his sleeves and fastened them. He told the woman that he would return the following day and change the dressings, and that he would leave the supplies with her and show her how he wished it to be done. He said that the boy must drink plenty of water, that they must keep him warm. Then he handed Billy his bag and turned, and the woman helped him on with his coat, and he took his hat and thanked her for her help and ducked out through the low door. Billy followed him out with the bag and intercepted the doctor coming around to the front of the car with the crank. He handed him the bag and took the crank from him.
Permítame, he said.
He bent in the dark and found the slot in the radiator grill with his fingers and fitted the crank and pushed it into the socket. Then he stood and swung the crank. The motor started and the doctor nodded.
Bueno, he said.
He stepped back along the fender and idled down the throttle and turned and took the crank handle from Billy and bent and stowed it under the seat.
Gracias, he said.
A usted.
The doctor nodded.
He looked toward the doorway where the woman stood, and he looked again at Billy. He took a cigarette from his pocket and put it in his mouth.
Se queda con su hermano, he said.
Sí, acepte el caballo, por favor.
The doctor said that he would not. He said that he would send his mozo with the horse in the morning.
He looked at the sky to the east, where the first gray light was shaping out the roof line of the hacienda from the accommodate darkness.
Ya este mañana, he said. Viene la madrugada.
Yes, said Billy.
Stay with your brother. I will send the horse.
Then he climbed into the car and pulled shut the door and switched on the lights. There was nothing to see, yet the ejiditarios had come to their doorways all down the wall of dwellings, men and women pale in the lights, pale in their clothes of unbleached cotton, children clutching at their knees, and all of them watching while the car trundled slowly past and swung around in the compound and went out and down the road with the dogs running alongside, howling and leaning to nip at the softly rumpling tires where they turned on the clay. When Boyd awoke late in the morning, Billy was sitting there, and when he woke midday and when he woke again in the evening, he was there. He sat nodding and tottering on into the twilight, and he was surprised to hear his name called.
Billy.
He opened his eyes. He leaned forward.
I don't have no water.
Let me get it. Where's the glass?
Right here. Billy.
What?
You got to go to Namiquipa.
I ain't going nowheres.
She'll think we just ditched her.
I can't leave you.
I'll be all right.
I can't go off down there and leave you.
Yeah, you can.
You need somebody to look after you.
Listen, Boyd said, I've done got over all that. Go on like I asked you. You was worried about the horse anyways.
The mozo arrived at noon the day following, riding a burro and leading Nino on a rope halter. The workers were in the fields, and he rode across the bridge and up past the row of their habitations, calling out as he went for Señor Paramo. Billy went out, and the mozo halted the burro and nodded to him.
Su caballo, he said.
He looked at the horse. The horse had been fed and curried and watered and rested, and looked another horse altogether, and he told the mozo so. The mozo nodded easily and undallied the end of the halter rope from the horn of his saddle and slid from the burro.
¿Por qué no montabo el caballo? Billy said.
The mozo shrugged. He said that it was not his horse to ride.
¿Quiere montarlo?
He shrugged again. He stood with the halter rope. Billy stepped to the horse and unlooped the bridle reins from the saddle horn where they'd been hung, and bridled the horse and let the reins fall and slid the halter off Nino's neck.
Andale, he said.
The mozo coiled the rope and hung it over the horn of the burro's saddle and walked around the horse and patted him and took up the reins and stepped into the stirrup and swung up. He turned the horse and rode out down the paseo between the row houses and put the horse into a trot and rode up the hill past the hacienda and turned there, for he would not take the horse out of sight. He backed the horse and turned it and rode a few figure eights and then galloped the horse down the hill and stopped it in a sliding squat before the door and stepped down, all in one motion.
¿Le gusta? Said Billy.
Claro que sí, said the mozo.
He leaned and put the flat of his hand on the horse's neck and then nodded and turned and climbed aboard the burro and rode out down the paseo without looking back. It was almost dark when he left. The Munoz woman tried to have him wait until morning, but he would not. The doctor had arrived in the late afternoon, and he had left the dressings for the woman and a package of Epsom salts, and the woman had fixed Boyd a tea made from manzanilla and arnica and the root of the golondrina bush. She'd put up provisions for Billy in an old canvas morral, and he slung it over the horn of the saddle and mounted up and turned the horse and looked down at her.
¿Dónde está la pistola? He said.
She said that it was under the pillow beneath his brother's head. He nodded. He looked out down the road toward the bridge and the river, and he looked at her again. He asked her if any men had been to the ejido.
Sí, she said, dos veces.
He nodded again.
Es peligroso para ustedes.
She nodded. She said that life was dangerous. She said that for a man of the people there was no choice. He smiled. ¿Mi hermano es un hombre del pueblo?
Sí, she said, claro.
He rode south along the road through the riverside cottonwoods, riding through the town of Mata Ortiz and riding the moon up out of the west to its cool meridian before he turned off and put up for the remainder of the night in a grove of trees he'd skylighted from the road. He rolled himself in his serape and hung his hat over the tops of his standing boots and did not wake till daylight. He rode all day the day following. Few cars passed, and he saw no riders. In the evening, the truck that had carried his brother to San Diego came lumbering down the road from the north in a slow uncoiling of road dust and ground to a stop. The workers on the bed of the truck waved and called out to him, and he rode up and pushed his hat back on his head and held up his hand to them. They gathered along the edge of the truck bed and held out their hands, and he leaned from the horse and shook hands with them, every man. They said that it was dangerous for him to be on the road. They did not ask about Boyd, and when he began to tell them, they waved away his words, for they had been to see him that very day. They said that he had eaten and that he'd drunk a small glass of pulque for the vigor in it, and that all signs were of the most affirmative nature. They said that only the hand of the Virgin could have sustained him through such a terrible wound.
Herida tan grave, they said, tan horrible, herida tan fea.
They spoke of his brother lying with the pistol under his pillow, and spoke in a high whisper.
Tan joven, they said, tan valiente, y peligroso por todo eso, como el tigre herido en su cueva.
Billy looked at them. He looked out across the cooling country to the west, the long bands of shadow. Doves were calling from the acacias. The workers believed that his brother had killed the Manco in a gunfight in the streets of Boquilla y Anejas, that the Manco had fired upon him without provocation, and what folly for the Manco who had not reckoned upon the great heart of the Guerrito. They pressed him for details, how the Guerrito had risen from his blood in the dust to draw his pistol and shoot the Manco dead from his horse. They addressed Billy with great reverence, and they asked him how it was that he and his brother had set out upon their path of justice. He scanned their faces. What he saw in those eyes was very moving to him. The driver and the two other men in the cab of the truck had got down and were standing along the bed of the truck at the rear. All waited to see what he would say. In the end, he told them that the accounts of the conflict were greatly exaggerated, and that his brother was only 15 years old, and that he himself was to blame, for he should have cared better for his brother. He should not have carried him off to a strange country to be shot down in the street like a dog. They only shook their heads and repeated among themselves Boyd's age.
15 años, they said. Qué guapo! Qué joven tan esforzado!
In the end, he thanked them for their care of his brother and touched the brim of his hat, at which they all crowded again with their hands outstretched, and he shook their hands again and the hands of the driver and the other two men standing in the road, and then reined the horse around and rode past the truck and out along the road south. He heard the truck doors slam behind him and heard the driver put the truck in gear, and they rumbled slowly past him in the augmenting dust. The workers on the bed of the truck waved, and some of them took off their hats, and then one of them stood and steadied himself by one hand on the shoulder of his companion and raised one fist in the air and shouted to him.
Hay justicia en el mundo, he called.
Then they all rode on. He woke that night with the ground trembling beneath him, and he sat up and looked for the horse. The horse stood with its head raised against the desert night sky, looking toward the west. A train was going down country, the pale yellow cone of the headlight boring slowly and sedately down the desert, and the distant clatter of the wheel trucks outlandish and mechanical in that dark waste of silence. Finally, the small square window light of the caboose trailing after. It passed and left only the faint pale track of boiler smoke hanging over the desert, and then came the long, lonesome whistle, echoing across the country where it called for the crossing at Las Varas. He rode into Boquilla at noon with the shotgun across the pommel of the saddle. There was no one about. He took the road south to Santa Ana de Babicora. Towards dark, he began to come upon riders riding north toward Boquilla, young men and boys with their black hair slicked down on their skulls and their boots polished, and the cheap cotton shirts they wore that had been pressed with hot bricks. It was Saturday night, and they were going to a dance. They nodded gravely, mounted on burros or on the little distaff mules from the mines. He nodded back, his eyes watching every movement, the shotgun upright against him with the buttstock cradled against his inner thigh. The good horse he rode flaring its nostrils at them. When he rode through La Pinta on the high juniper plain above the Santa Maria River Valley, the moon was up, and when he rode into Santa Ana de Babicura, it was midnight and the town was dark and empty. He watered the horse in the Alameda and took the road west to Namiquipa. An hour's ride, he came to a small stream that was part of the headwaters of the Santa Maria, and turned the horse off down out of the road and hobbled him in the river grass, and rolled himself into his serape and slept in dreamless exhaustion. When he woke, the sun was hours high. He walked down to the creek carrying his boots and stood in the water and bent and washed his face. When he raised up and looked for the horse was standing looking toward the road. In a few minutes, a rider came along. Coming down the road on the horse his mother used to ride was the girl, wearing a new dress of blue cotton and a small straw hat with a green ribbon that hung down her back. Billy watched her pass, and when she was out of sight, he sat in the grass and studied his boots standing there, and the slow passing of the small river, and the tops of the grass that bent and recovered constantly in the morning breeze. Then he reached for the boots and pulled them on and stood and walked up and bridled and saddled the horse and mounted up and rode out into the road and set out behind her. When she heard the horse on the road, she put her hand on top of her hat and turned and looked back. Then she stopped. He slowed the horse and rode up to her. She fixed him with her dark eyes.
¿Está muerto? She said. ¿Está muerto?
No.
No me mienta.
Le juro por Dios.
Gracias a Dios, gracias a Dios.
She slid from the horse and dropped the reins and knelt in her new clothes in the dry, rutted clay of the road and blessed herself and closed her eyes and folded her hands to pray. An hour later, when they rode back through Santa Ana de Babicora, she'd still hardly spoken. It was almost noon, and they rode up the one mud street past the low-slung rows of slumped mud buildings and the half-dozen painted trees that composed the Alameda, and on across the upland desert plain again. He saw nothing that looked like a tienda in the town, and he'd nothing with which to buy anything if there had been one. She rode a sedate dozen paces behind him, and he looked back at her once or twice, but she did not smile nor acknowledge him in any way, and after a while he didn't look any more. He knew she'd not left her house without provisions, but she didn't mention it, and neither did he. A little ways north of the town she spoke behind him, and he stopped and turned the horse in the road.
¿Tienes hambre? She said.
He thumbed his hat back and looked at her. I could eat the run and gears of a bull moose, he said.
Mande?
They ate in a grove of acacia by the roadside. She spread her serape and laid out tortillas in a cloth and tamales in their corded wraps of corn husk, and a small jar of frijoles from which she unscrewed the lid and in which she stood a wooden spoon. She opened a cloth containing four empanadas, 2 ears of cold corn dusted with red chili powder, the quarter part of a small wheel of goat cheese. She sat with her legs tucked under her, her head turned for the brim of her hat to shade her face. They ate. When he asked her didn't she want to know about Boyd, she said she already knew. He watched her. She seemed fragilely wrapped in her clothing. On her left wrist there was a blue discoloration. Other than that, her skin was so perfect it appeared oddly false, as if it had been painted on.
¿Tienes miedo de los hombres? He said. ¿Cuáles hombres?
Todos los hombres. She turned and looked at him. She looked down. He thought that she was reflecting upon the question, but she only brushed an escarabajo from the serape and reached and took up one of the empanadas and bit delicately into it.
Y quizás tienes razón, he said. Quizás.
She looked off to where the horses stood in the roadside grass, their tails whisking. He thought she would say no more, but she began to talk about her family. She said that her grandmother had been widowed by the Revolution and married again and was widowed again within the year, and married a third time and was a third time widowed, and wed no more, although there were opportunities enough for her to do so, as she was a great beauty and not yet 20 years of age when the last husband fell, as detailed by his own uncle at Torreón, with one hand over his breast in a gesture of fidelity sworn, clutching the rifle ball to him like a gift, the sword and pistol he carried falling away behind him, useless in the palmettos, in the sand, the riderless horse stepping about in the melee of shot and shell and the cries of men, trotting off with the stirrups flapping, coming back, wandering in silhouette with others of its kind among the bodies of the dead on that senseless plain, while the dark drew down around them all about, and small birds, driven from their arbors in the thorns, returned and flitted about and chittered, and the moon rose blind and white in the east, and the little jackal-wolves came trotting that would eat the dead from out of their clothes. She said that her grandmother was skeptical of many things in this world, and of none more than men. She said that in every trade save war, men of talent and vigor prosper. In war they die. Her grandmother spoke to her often of men, and she spoke with great earnestness. And she said that rash men were a great temptation to women, and this was simply a misfortune like others, and there was little that could be done to remedy it. She said that to be a woman was to live a life of difficulty and heartbreak, and those who said otherwise simply had no wish to face the facts. And she said that since this was so, nor could it be altered, one was better to follow one's heart in joy and in misery than simply to seek comfort, for there was none. To seek it was only to welcome in the misery and to know little else. She said that these were things all women knew, yet seldom spoke of. Lastly, she said that if women were drawn to rash men, it was only that in their secret hearts they knew that a man who would not kill for them was of no use at all. She had finished eating. She sat with her hands folded in her lap, and the things she'd said sorted oddly with her composure. The road was empty, the country silent. He asked her if she thought that Boyd would kill a man. She turned and studied him, as if he were someone for whom words must be weighed so as to accommodate their understanding. Finally, she said that the word was abroad in the country, that all the world knew that the Guerrito had killed the Gerente from Las Varitas. The man who had betrayed Socorro Rivera and sold out his own people to the Guardia Blanca of La Babicora. Billy listened to all this, and when she was done, he said that the Manco had fallen from his horse and broken his back, and that he himself had seen it happen. He waited. After a while, she looked up. ¿Quieres algo más? She said. No, gracias. She began to pack up the remains of their picnic. He watched her, but he made no move to help. He rose, and she folded the serape and rolled the remainder of the provisions in it and retied it with the cords. No sabes nada de mi hermano, he said. Quizás, she said. She stood with the rolled serape over her shoulder. ¿Por qué no me contesta? He said. She looked up at him. She said that she had answered him. She said that in every family there is one who is different, and the others believe that they know that person, but they do not know that person. She said that she herself was such a one, and knew whereof she spoke. Then she turned and walked out to where the horses were grazing in the dusty roadside weeds, and tied the serape on behind the cantle, and tightened the cinch, and stood up into the saddle. He mounted up and rode the horse past her into the road. Then he stopped and looked back. He said that there were things about his brother that only his family could know, and that as his family was dead, there was no one who knew save he. Every small thing, any time that he was sick as a child, or the day he was bitten by a scorpion and thought he was going to die, or any of his life in another part of the country that even Boyd remembered little of or none at all, including his grandmother and his twin sister dead and buried in that long ago in a place he'd likely never see again. ¿Sabías que él tenía una gemela? He said. ¿Que murió cuando tenía 5 años? She said that she did not know that Boyd had once had a twin sister or that she died, but that it was not important, for now he had another. Then she put the horse forward and went past him and into the road. An hour later they overtook 3 young girls afoot. 2 of them carried a basket between them with a cloth over it. They were on their way to the pueblo of Sotomayores, and they had yet a ways to go. They looked back when they heard the riders on the road behind them, and they huddled together, laughing, and when the riders passed, they pushed one another to the verge of the road and looked up with their quick dark eyes and laughed behind their hands. Billy touched his hat and rode on, but the girl stopped and walked the horse beside them, and when he looked back, she was talking to them. They were little younger than she, but she was calling them to task in that same low, flat voice. Finally, they stopped and stood back against the roadside chaparral, but here she halted the horse entirely and continued until she was done. Then she turned and put the horse forward and did not look back. They rode all day. It was dark when they entered La Boquilla, and he rode through the town as he had come, with the shotgun upright before him. When they passed the spot where the Manco had fallen, she made the sign of the cross and kissed her fingers. Then they rode on. The sparse trunks of the painted Alameda trees stood pale as bone in the light from the windows. Some windows of glass, but mostly oiled butcher paper, tacked up in frames, and behind them neither movement nor shadow, but only those sallow squares, like parchments or old barren maps, long weathered of any trace of their terrains or roots upon them. On the outskirts of the settlement there was a fire burning just off the roadside, and they slowed and rode past cautiously, but the fire appeared to be only a trash fire, and there was no one about, and they rode on into the dark country to the west. That night they camped in a swale at the edge of the lake and shared the last of the provisions she'd brought. When he asked her would she not have been afraid to ride through this country by herself at night, she said that there was no remedy for it and that one must put oneself in the care of God. He asked if God always looked after her, and she studied the heart of the fire for a long time, where the coals breathed bright and dull and bright again in the wind from the lake. At last she said that God looked after everything, and that one could no more evade his care than evade his judgment. She said that even the wicked could not escape his love. He watched her. He said that he himself had no such idea of God, and that he'd pretty much given up praying to him. And she nodded without taking her eyes from the fire, and said that she knew that. She took her blanket and went off down by the lake. He watched her go, and then shucked off his boots and rolled his serape about him and fell into a troubled sleep. He woke sometime in the night or in the early morning and turned and looked at the fire to see how long he'd slept, but the fire was all but cold on the ground. He looked to the east to see if there were any trace of dawn graying over the country, but there was only the darkness and the stars. He prodded the ashes with a stick. The few red coals that turned up in the fire's black heart seemed secret and improbable, like the eyes of things disturbed that had best been left alone. He rose and walked down to the lake with the serape about his shoulders, and he looked at the stars in the lake. The wind had died and the water lay black and still. It lay like a hole in that high desert world, down into which the stars were drowning. Something had woke him, and he thought perhaps he'd heard riders on the road and that they'd seen his fire, but there was no fire to see. And then he thought perhaps the girl had risen and come to the fire and stood over him where he slept. And he remembered tasting rain on his face, but there was no rain, nor had there been, and then he remembered his dream. In the dream, he was in another country that was not this country, and the girl who knelt by him was not this girl. They knelt in the rain in a darkened city, and he held his dying brother in his arms, but he could not see his face, and he could not say his name. Somewhere among the black and dripping streets a dog howled. That was all. He looked out at the lake where there was no wind, but only the dark stillness and the stars, and yet he felt a cold wind pass. He crouched in the sedge by the lake, and he knew he feared the world to come, for in it were already written certainties no man would wish for. He saw pass, as in a slow tapestry unrolled, images of things seen and unseen. He saw the she-wolf dead in the mountains, and the hawk's blood on the stone. And he saw a glass hearse with black drapes pass in a street carried on poles by mozos. He saw the castaway bow floating on the cold waters of the Bevispe like a dead serpent, and the solitary sexton in the ruins of the town where the Terremoto had passed, and the hermit in the broken transept of the church at Caborca. He saw rainwater dripping from a light bulb screwed into the sheet-iron wall of a warehouse. He saw a goat with golden horns tethered in a field of mud. Lastly, he saw his brother standing in a place where he could not reach him, windowed away in some world where he could never go. When he saw him there, he knew that he had seen him so in dreams before, and he knew that his brother would smile at him, and he waited for him to do so, a smile which he had evoked and to which he could find no meaning to ascribe, and he wondered if what at last he'd come to was that he could no longer tell that which had passed from all that was but a seeming. He must have knelt there a long time, because the sky in the east did grow gray with dawn, and the stars sank at last to ash in the paling lake, and the birds began to call from the far shore, and the world to appear again once more. They rode out early with nothing to eat save the last few tortillas dried and hardening at the edges. She rode behind him, and they did not speak, and in this manner they rode at noon across the Wooden River Bridge and into Las Varas. There were a few people about. They bought beans and tortillas at a small tienda, and they bought 4 tamales from an old woman who sold them in the street out of a steel oil drum sashed up in a wooden frame with cast-iron wheels from off an ore cart. The girl paid the woman, and they sat in a stack of pinyon firewood behind a store and ate in silence. The tamales smelled and tasted of charcoal. While they were eating, a man approached them and smiled and nodded. Billy looked at the girl. She looked at him. He looked at the horse and at the stock of the shotgun jutting from the boot under the saddle. "No me recuerdas," the man said. Billy looked at him again. He looked at his boots. It was the arriero last seen on the steps of the opera caravan in the roadside grove south of San Diego. "Le conozco," Billy said. "Cómo la va?" "Bien." He looked at the girl. "¿Dónde está su hermano?" "Y está en San Diego." The arriero nodded sagely, as if he understood some situation. "¿Dónde está la caravana?" said Billy. He said he did not know. He said that they had waited by the side of the road, but that no one had ever returned. "¿Cómo no?" The arriero shrugged. He made a chopping motion with the heel of his hand out through the air. "Se fue," he said. "Con el dinero?" "Claro." He said that they'd been left without resources or any means to travel. At the time of his own departure, the dueña had sold all the mules, save one, and bickering had broken out. When Billy asked what she would do, he shrugged again. He looked away down the street. He looked at Billy. He asked him if he could spare him a few pesos so that he could get something to eat. Billy said that he had no money, but the girl had already risen and walked out to the horse, and when she returned, she gave the arriero some coins, and he thanked her a number of times and bowed and touched his hat and put the coins in his pocket and wished them a good voyage and turned and went off down the street and disappeared into the sole cantina in that upland pueblo. "Pobrecito," the girl said. Billy spat into the dry grass. He said that the arriero was probably lying, and besides, he was only a drunk, and she should not have given him money. Then he got up and walked out to where the horses were standing and buckled the latigo and took up the reins, and mounted up and rode out, up through the town toward the railroad tracks and the road north, without even looking back to see if she would follow. In the 3 days' riding that took them to San Diego, she spoke hardly at all. The last night she had wanted to keep riding on in the dark to reach the ejido, but he would not. They camped on the river some miles south of Mata Ortiz, and he built a fire of driftwood on a gravel bar in the river, and she cooked the last of the dried beans and tortillas, which was all the rations they'd had to eat since they left Las Varas. They ate, seated across from each other, while the fire burned down to a frail basket of coals, and the moon rose in the east, and overhead, very high and very faint, they could hear the calls of birds moving south. And they could see them trail in slender cipherings across the deeply smoldering western rim and into the dusk and the darkness beyond. "Las grullas llegan," she said. He watched them. The cranes were moving south, and he watched their thin echelons trail along those unseen corridors writ in their blood 100,000 years. He watched them until they were gone, and the last thin fluted cry like a child's horn floated away on the night's onset. And then she rose and took her serape and walked off down the gravel bar and vanished among the cottonwoods. They rode across the plankwood bridge and up to the old hacienda at noon the following day. People stood all along in the doorways of the domicilios who should have been in the fields, and he realized that it was some feast day of the calendar. He rode past her and pulled the horse up in front of the Munoz door, and dismounted and dropped the reins and pulled off his hat and ducked and entered the low doorway. Boyd was sitting on the pallet with his back against the wall. The flame of the votive candle heeled about in the glass above his head, and swathed as he was in his wraps of sheeting, he looked like someone sat suddenly upright at his own vigil. The mute dog had been lying down, and it stood and moved against him. "¿Dónde estabas?" Boyd said. He wasn't talking to his brother. He was talking to the girl who came smiling through the doorway behind him. The next day, he rode out down the river, and he was gone all day. High thin skeins of wildfowl were moving down country, and leaves were falling in the river, willow and cottonwood, coiling and turning in the current. Their shadows, where they skated over the river stones, looked like writing. It was dark when he returned, riding the horse up through the smoke of the cook fires from pool to pool of light, like a mounted sentry posted to patrol the watch fires of a camp. In the days to follow, he worked with the herders, driving sheep down from the hills and through the high-vaulted gate of the compound where the animals milled and climbed against each other, and the esquiladores stood at the ready with their shears. They drove the sheep half a dozen at a time into the high-ceilinged and ruinous storeroom, and the esquiladores stood them between their knees and clipped them by hand, and young boys gathered the wool up from off the rain-cupped boards of the floor and stamped it into the long cotton bags with their feet. It was cool in the evening, and he would sit by the fire and drink coffee with the ejiditarios, while the dogs of the compound moved from fire to fire, scavenging for scraps. By now, Boyd was riding out in the evening, sitting the horse stiffly and riding at a walk with the girl riding Nino close beside him. He'd lost his hat in the fray on the river, and he wore an old straw hat they'd found for him and a shirt made from striped ticking. After they'd come back, Billy would walk out to where the horses were hobbled below the domicilios and ride Nino bareback down to the river and wade the horse out into the darkening shallows where he'd seen the naked dueña at her bath, and the horse would drink and raise its dripping muzzle, and they would listen together to the river passing and to the sound of ducks somewhere on the water, and sometimes the high thin cranking of the flights of cranes still passing south a mile above the river. He rode down the far bank in the twilight, and he could see in the river loam among the cottonwoods the tracks of the horses where Boyd had passed, and he followed the tracks to see where they had gone, and he tried to guess the thoughts of the rider who had made them. When he walked back up to the compound, it was late, and he entered the low door and sat on the pallet where his brother lay sleeping. "Boyd," he said. His brother woke and turned and lay in the pale candlelight and looked up at him. It was warm in the room from the day's heat seeping back out of the mud walls, and Boyd was naked to the waist. He'd taken the wrapping from about his chest, and he was paler than his brother could ever remember, and so thin with the rack of his ribs stark against the pale skin, and when he turned in the reddish light, Billy could see the hole in his chest for just a moment, and he turned his eyes away like a man unwittingly made privy to some secret thing to which he was in no way entitled, for which he was in no way prepared. Boyd pulled the muslin cover up and lay back and looked at him, his long, pale, uncut hair all about him and his face so thin. "What is it?" he said. "Talk to me. Go to bed. I need for you to talk to me. It's okay. Everything's okay." "No, it ain't." "You just worry about stuff. I'm all right." "I know you are," said Billy. "But I ain't."
3 days later, when he woke in the morning and walked out, they were gone. He walked out to the end of the row and looked down toward the river. His father's horse, standing in the field, raised its head and looked at him and looked out down the road toward the river and the river bridge and the road beyond. He got his things from the house and saddled the horse and rode out. He said goodbye to no one. He sat the horse in the road beyond the river cottonwoods, and he looked off down country at the mountains, and he looked to the west where thunderheads were standing sheared off from the thin dark horizon, and he looked at the deep cyanic sky taut and vaulted over the whole of Mexico, where the antique world clung to the stones and to the spores of living things and dwelt in the blood of men. He turned the horse and set out along the road south, shadowless in the gray day, riding with the shotgun unscabbarded across the bow of the saddle. For the enmity of the world was newly plain to him that day, and cold and inameliorate as it must be to all who have no longer cause except themselves to stand against it. He looked for them for weeks, but he found only shadow and rumor. He found the little heart-shaped milagro in the watch pocket of his jeans, and he hooked it out with his forefinger and held it in the palm of his hand, and he studied it long and long. He rode as far south as Cuauhtémoc. He rode north again to Namiquipa, but could find no one who owned to know the girl, and he rode as far west as La Norteña and the watershed, and he grew thin and gaunted in his travels and pale with the dust of the road, but he never saw them again. He sat the horse at dawn in the crossroads at Buenaventura and watched waterfowl trailing over the river and the lonely lagunas, the dark liquid movement of their wings against the red sunrise. He passed back north through the small mud hamlets of the Mesa, through Alamo and Galeana, settlements through which he'd passed before and where his return was remarked upon by the Poblanos, so that his own journeying began to take upon itself the shape of a tale. It was cold at night on the high plains in these early days of December, and he had little to keep him warm. When he rode once more into Casas Grandes, he'd not eaten in 2 days, and it was past midnight and a cold rain falling. He rapped long at the Saguan gates. Toward the rear of the house, a dog barked. Finally, a light came on. When the mozo opened the gate and looked out to see him standing there in the rain holding the horse, he did not seem surprised. He asked after his brother, and Billy said that his brother had recovered from his wounds, but that he had disappeared, and he apologized for the hour, but wished to know if he might see the doctor. The mozo said that the hour was of no consequence, for the doctor was dead. He didn't ask the mozo when had the doctor died or of what cause. He stood with his hat and held it in both hands before him. "Lo siento," he said. The mozo nodded. They stood there in silence, and then the boy put on his hat and turned and put one foot into the stirrup and stood up into the saddle and sat the dark, wet horse and looked down at the mozo. He said that the doctor had been a good man, and he looked off down the street toward the lights of the town, and he looked again at the mozo.
"Nadie sabe lo que le espera en este mundo," said the mozo.
"De veras," said the boy. He nodded and touched his hat, and turned and rode back down the darkened street.